Well, I too, is this on? I too would like to thank the organizers and to congratulate them for organizing such a wonderful meeting in India and giving us a chance to visit their beautiful country. The title of my talk was originally Non-Commutative Gauge Theory, and I intended to discuss some work that I've been doing over the last year in this field, mostly with Nikita Nekrasov and with Aki Hashimoto and Nissan Yitzhaki. So the original outline of my talk was to provide an introduction to non-commutative gauge theories and why they are of interest in the exploration both of string theory and of Yang-Mills theories. And then I was going to present our rather complete analysis of codimension 2 solitons, classical solutions in these theories, a whole variety of explicit solitonic solutions, fluxons, which in two dimensions describe vortices, and in three dimensions are field theoretic descriptions of D1 strings, piercing D3 brains at various angles. Some of them are stable, some of them are unstable. I was going to discuss their properties, the fluctuations about them. And then I was going to discuss a bit of the analysis of observables in non-commutative gauge theories, which are rather unusual because translations and gauge transformations are mixed up. And in particular, the analysis of local, the non-commutative version of local gauge invariant observables in non-commutative gauge theories, and discuss the analysis of the straight Wilson lines and how they can be used to construct quote-unquote local observables in non-commutative gauge theories that Hashimoto and Itzhaki and I discussed. Where we argue that these are the appropriate variables that are dual to the bulk fields in ADS. However, much of what I plan to do has been or will be discussed by other people. Gopakumar and Minwala gave a comprehensive introduction to non-commutative gauge theories and their properties, and their discussion of solitons, and I think probably that of Harvey's, overlaps a lot with our work. Uguri will be discussing, I think, these observables, and in particular, the duality to ADS fields, and perhaps DAS as well. So that the only subject that that I was going to discuss that will not be discussed by someone else as well is the explicit construction that Nekrasov and I have done of the non-commutative U1 and U2 magnetic monopoles, which are the non-commutative gauge theory analogs of D1 strings attached to D3 brains or D1 strings stretching between separated D3 brains, in which part of the gauge symmetry is Higgs. However, that is a rather technical and involved discussion, and you would be overwhelmed with formulas. It's very interesting, but I decided instead to simply change subjects. And instead, I'm going to talk about a recent paper that Nadav Drucker and I have written called an exact prediction of n=4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory and its comparison with string theory. So what I'm going to tell you about is a claim that a circular BPS, particularly supersymmetric Wilson loop, in n=4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory in four dimensions, the theory dual to type 2B string theory in ADS 5 cross S5, can be calculated exactly to all orders in the string in the Yang-Mills coupling and to all orders in n, or 1 over n. And the answer is this. L1 sub n minus 1 is a generalized Laguerre polynomial. Lambda is the Ad-Hooft coupling. And this, we argue, is the exact answer of a circular Wilson loop to all orders. And I'm going to present the arguments that lead us to this conclusion and then compare it using ADS-CFT duality to the predictions of string theory. Now we, having this expression for all coupling, there's a region of overlap with string theory, where we cannot so far calculate this observable exactly, but we can for small alpha prime, which corresponds to large gauge coupling in a 1 over n expansion. And in fact, we will compare this result and get agreement to all orders, to leading order in alpha prime, but to all orders in 1 over n squared. Okay, so let me remind you about Wilson loops in the ADS-CFT correspondence. They've played an important role in understanding that duality. And as first was proposed by Maldacena and Ray, and then analyzed in some detail by Oguri, Drucker, and myself, the expectation value, the appropriate Wilson loop to discuss in comparing Yang-Mills theory and the dual string theory is a Wilson loop which corresponds to taking a BPS particle around a contour. And so it differs from the ordinary Wilson loop we consider, which only involves the holonomy of the gauge field, by having an extra coupling to the scalar field that go along in the supersymmetric multiplet. And this is, in fact, the supersymmetric BPS loop that will be dual to the sum over all surfaces in string theory in a string perturbative expansion that live in the bulk and have as a boundary the contour that we're interested in on the R4 boundary of ADS5. Notice that the scalar enters here with an I. That's important. Theta is a unit vector on the 5 sphere. And I labels one of the 6 components of the scalar field. Notice here that the coupling is through the absolute value of the velocity, whereas the coupling of the gauge field is to the velocity. Now, the ADS-C correspondence tells us that we can calculate the expectation value of this Wilson loop, as I said, either in gauge theory by standard techniques, if we have them, or in type 2B string theory by summing over all surfaces with this boundary. with appropriate boundary conditions. And the boundary conditions are a bit subtle, and as we discussed with Drucker and Ogori. Now, in string theory, of course, we have very little information, very little tools as to how to do these calculations in ADS5 to date. But the leading semi-classical or small alpha prime expression can be easily derived, since it should be given by the surface of minimal area with these boundary conditions. And so for a very small alpha prime, which, as you remember, translates in the gauge theory to very strong coupling, and for very large n, we need only consider the contribution of the surface of lowest genus and of minimal area. Actually, when the boundary conditions are explored carefully, one finds that the action differs from the Nambu-Goto action by a boundary term, which renders this calculation finite from the beginning and doesn't play much else of a role. So that for a very strong coupling, we could calculate this loop from string theory, this Wilson loop for an arbitrary contour, by simply calculating the minimal area. And there are a few loops for which it is possible analytically to derive the expression for the minimal area subtended by this contour. The original calculation of Maldacena and Ray dealt with a square, very long Wilson loop, which yields the quark-antiquark potential in gauge theory and gave a Coulomb-like potential, as one would expect in a conformally invariant theory, with a determined coefficient and a factor of square root of lambda. The case which I'm going to be discussing is that of a circle. And there, too, it's easy to find the minimal area solution. And there, one expects that the area, this is the area in appropriate units, of course, is independent of the radius because of scale invariance. So it's a pure number. There are no ratios of distances that could come in. And the number, in fact, minus the boundary term is minus 1. So that for large coupling, the Wilson loop should just go like e to the square root of lambda. Well, this is fine and very beautiful that we can derive from string theory results for gauge theory for strong coupling, but we have nothing to compare them with because we can't calculate the expectation value of Wilson loops for large coupling. However, there is one Wilson loop which we can calculate for large coupling, both in string theory and in gauge theory. And that is a straight line Wilson loop. So we just have a straight line extending to infinity. Well, that, if we imagine the length of that straight line is t, as t goes to infinity, that Wilson loop essentially gives us e to the minus t times the mass shift of the state described by this parallel transport along the loop. Now, that state is, by construction, a BPS state. So there is no mass renormalization. And therefore, this Wilson loop for a straight line should be 1 to all orders in the coupling and to all orders in 1 over n. And that's certainly true in the gauge theory, and one can prove that systematically, order by order in perturbation theory. And it certainly should be true in string theory as well. And one can see that easily in the semi-classical approximation and any formulation of these sum over surfaces in ADS5 will yield the same result. It's interesting to see how that works in perturbation theory. Perturbation theory, you have corrections to the Wilson loop, second order in coupling, coming from scalar and gluon exchange. And you see, remember the scalar coupled with the absolute value of the velocity. So the scalar contribution looks like this, and it had an extra I. And the vector contribution, the gluon contribution, had the velocity at one point contracted with the velocity at the other point. So it yields an expression like this. But for a straight line, of course, these vectors are parallel, so this scalar product is equal to this scalar product, and because of the I squared, these cancel. And so the gluons and the scalar contributions, as usual for BPS states, cancel, and this is what occurs to all orders in perturbation theory. So here we have an exact comparison between string theory and gauge theory, but it's rather trivial. Now, N equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory is conformally invariant. It's invariant under special conformal transformations. And among those special conformal, among conformal transformations, there are conformal transformations that take a straight line to a circle. If you perform an inversion around the origin, then a straight line will be mapped to a circle. The point at infinity will be mapped to the point at the origin, and so a circle and a straight line are equivalent, you would think, in a conformally invariant theory. And therefore, you might deduce that if the Wilson loop for a straight line is 1, then the Wilson loop for a circle is also 1. Well, that would be a pretty disastrous conclusion because we've calculated here the leading semi-classical contribution in string theory to the expectation value of the Wilson loop for small alpha prime or large coupling, and it's certainly not 1. So something must be wrong with this argument. So what goes wrong? Well, let's look, in fact, at the same perturbative calculation. Now for a circle and not a straight line. Now we have the scalar propagator and the gluon propagator. And this one, remember, is minus I squared proportional to the products of the absolute values of the velocity, and this one just to the products of the velocity of the endpoints. And now these don't cancel because the velocities are not parallel at x1 and x2. But it's trivial to work out this ratio, and it comes out to be a half. Minus a half, independent of the positions x1 and x2. So it's not 0. In fact, this naive argument is breaking down even to lowest order in perturbation theory. But it's a very simple answer. It's just a constant, and you can easily integrate a constant around the loop. You just get a 2 pi r radius squared when you integrate over x1 and x2, and you can then calculate w0 to be 1 plus a correction, lambda over 8. Now, one of the motivations for our work was a beautiful paper by Erickson, Semenov, and Zarembo, who summed all the rainbow graphs. The rainbow graphs are a class of graphs, planar graphs, that survive in the large n limit. They're, of course, not all the planar graphs, but they're a simple set. And this sum is very trivial to do because each propagator here is a sum of the scalar and gluon propagators, and it's just equal to minus a half. So summing these graphs is just a counting problem. You just have to count the number of rainbow graphs, and you weight them by powers of the coupling, and you get a sum that sums to a Bessel function. And when you look at the asymptotic behavior of the Bessel function, it goes like e to the square root of lambda, exactly as we got from string theory in the large lambda behavior. So the question we asked is, why is the circle non-trivial? What is wrong with this naive argument of conformal invariance? Is conformal invariance breaking down in n equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory? And second of all, why do the rainbow graphs agree with the exact, with the string theory for strong coupling at n equals infinity and maybe beyond? So let's discuss conformal invariants and a conformal anomaly that we argue exists in this theory. N equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory is conformally invariant, but only for small conformal transformations that don't transform the point at infinity to a finite point, or a finite point to the point at infinity. And then it's okay. I'm sorry. This is a typo. And it's certainly okay on S4, on the sphere. However, on the R4, there is a problem with large transformations, like inversions, that take the point to at infinity to a finite point. For example, such conformal transformations, when applied to n-point functions, would take them to n minus 1-point functions. Now, in order to relate a line to a circle, you need to perform such a large conformal transformation, like an inversion, that takes the point to at infinity to the origin to a finite point. And that might be problematic. But if it is, if observables are not invariant under large conformal transformations, then surely the difference between a calculation for a line and that for a conformally transformed line only comes from this one point. And that suggests that if there is a problem, an anomaly, a non-zero result of something which otherwise by symmetry arguments is zero, then the difference, say, between a circle and a line, the Wilson loop for this and that, should be given totally in terms of the fields, the physics occurring at one point, and therefore by a matrix model. And therefore, this kind, if there is an anomaly, a problem dealing with, correctly with a point at infinity, then we should be able, perhaps, to calculate it, because it will reduce to zero-dimensional field theory, just physics happening at that one point. And that's what we will argue. So let's go back over the perturbative analysis of the Wilson loops in gauge theory and see what happens under inversion, what goes wrong with the argument of conformal invariance. When we did the calculation, I showed you the direct calculation. You don't get zero for a circle, but you should, because it's conformally related to zero. So let's compare these two calculations. You could take the calculation of the straight line, which gives zero, perform a conformal transformation, and you would think that you would just get the calculation of the Wilson circular Wilson loop, which therefore should give zero, but it doesn't. So what goes wrong? Well, the scalar propagator transforms very trivially. A scalar field under inversion transforms in a way determined by its dimension. And the scalar propagator under inversion goes over to this expression. And if you see that the velocity transforms with the 1 over x squared, then the contribution of the scalar propagator to the Wilson loop is explicitly, manifestly invariant under inversion. So the scalar contribution to this to a straight line and to a circle are identical. However, that's not necessarily the case when we look at the gluon propagator. A vector field, the gauge field, transforms in this way under inversions, where I mu nu is this tensor whose square is 1. And that can be easily derived by looking at how the derivative operator, ddx mu, transforms under inversions, same way. And the propagator, therefore, in Feynman gauge, transforms like this under inversion. And if you work that out, it has these extra terms, which will be canceled in the same way as here. But in addition to the old propagator, it has a new term. It's not manifestly invariant. So why does the theory have any kind of conformal invariance? And the theory does have conformal invariance. If you take one circle and make a general conformal transformation that takes that circle to another circle, you do get the same result. And that's because these extra terms in the propagator are really total derivatives. They're just like gauge terms. And by naive arguments, they'll never contribute to gauge invariant observables. And that's absolutely correct, except for perhaps singular points. And if you look at the expression that appears here, it's rather complicated, but you see it has potential singularities when x equals y, when the points are the usual ultraviolet region, but also when x and y are equal to 0, and that's the inversion point. I've made an inversion around the origin. That's the point that goes to infinity. So if you look at the inversion transformation of the gluon propagator, you see that you would again have manifest conformal invariance, except because this is just like a gauge variation, except perhaps from these singular region. If the contour, x can always be equal to y for any contour, but if the contour goes through the origin, where x is 0 along the contour and y can be 0, then there's an extra singularity, and that might be a particularly dangerous point, and it is. In fact, if you then do go back and do look at the one loop calculation, now expressing the difference between the straight line, which is 0, and the circle as this extra term in the gluon propagator, it's a total derivative of this singular gauge transformation. And in fact, you would get 0, except you will get 0 unless the contour passes through the inversion point, passes through x equals 0, where you have multiple singularities here. In fact, you will get 0 unless you consider, except for the region coming where both x and y are close to 0. Once again, all the physics of the anomaly is coming from the place where everything is happening at this one point, the inversion point, which is mapped to infinity. And in the vicinity of that region, this total derivative essentially behaves like a delta function, singular enough to give a contribution, and it gives a number, minus an eighth, which agrees with our calculation before, directly. In fact, this argument tells you that the form of this anomaly is quite universal. If you take any long Wilson line, take any closed Wilson loop, C, closed contour, and perform an inversion around one point on the contour, this point will go to infinity, and this closed contour will be mapped to an open contour, which will asymptote to straight lines far away. Evaluating the Wilson loop for these two contours will not yield the same result because of the anomaly that will occur near this point. But in the infinitesimal neighborhood of a point, it always looks like a circle, and the answer will be universal. So the difference between a contour and a contour you get by inversion is universal and independent of the shape of the contour. It's just that in the case of the straight line, we know the answer. We know that it's 1, and therefore all corrections are 0, and we can use this anomaly, if you want, to calculate the value of the closed contour. Now we try to generalize this treatment to all orders in perturbation theory. So we consider, again, starting with a straight line, all of whose contributions, order by order and perturbation theory, canceled because of supersymmetry and conformal invariance. Conformal invariance is really necessary to make sure that the, you know, we have no problems with ultraviolet divergences. The theory is finite. And again, if you examine what happens order by order in perturbation theory, there are contributions now from graphs like this, you see, where here we have corrections to the propagators, which come from making this inversion. These look like total derivatives. And they contribute, they will give nothing except from the singular points by the usual Ward identities that embody gauge invariance. But when the contour goes through the inversion point, you can get a contribution coming from these corrections to the propagator when all the ends of the vertices, the propagator, are near this inversion point. The rest of the propagators that don't have these corrections that appear in these graphs contribute nothing, because they come from, they're related by conformal transformations to contributions to the straight line that cancel identically. And so whatever happens here with these corrections from these anomalous contributions to the propagator, they're only going to come when all of these points here are strictly at zero. And therefore, the result of doing these calculations order by order is going to be given by some zero-dimensional field theory, otherwise known as a matrix model. Now, if you look at how these terms contribute, now the anomalous pieces of the propagator, it appears that only non-intergracting graphs survive. This is explicitly confirmed in that paper by Erickson and Zaremba, who actually did a calculated graphs to fourth order and showed that they canceled exactly. We don't have a rigorous proof of that. It's very hard, because to really prove it precisely, one would need to regulate these graphs, even though they are finite. This is a finite theory. There are no UV divergences. However, the contribution here is coming from a region where all the points are coinciding. So it's rather singular, to say the least. But we're pretty convinced that the only graphs that can contribute are ones that are involve just free propagators, so that we get the maximal looking singularities where both ends of these propagators, x and y, are on the contour and are both going to zero at the same time. But we certainly cannot, as we did in the original version of this paper, claim to have proved that. And I think to really prove that, one would need to have a manifestly regularized or work with some superfield formulation that was manifestly finite as one to make such an argument precise. If it is true that there are that the interacting graphs all coming together at this point do not contribute, then the matrix model that summarizes the results of the counting is extremely simple. This is not just the sum of rainbow graphs, since I'm not taking n to infinity. It's the sum of all free non-interacting graphs in Feynman gauge. And it's just given by a quadratic Gaussian matrix model. The matrix model, M is an n by n Hermitian matrix. Trace of e to the m represents the Wilson loop. When you expand in powers of m, you get the ends of these propagators. And this just does the color index counting. This matrix model is for another reason what one might expect here. This is a theory with maximal supersymmetry. And this is the matrix model, for those of you who remember matrix models way back then, that is related to the C equals minus 2 trivial matrix model in the old days. It's the simplest matrix model, and if anything is going to be simple, it should be the n equals 4 case. So this function that we would get by calculating this matrix model, we call f, and it should be, if our argument is really correct, the expectation value of the circular Wilson loop exactly. And in fact, even more, by the I argued previously that one could make the same argument for generic loops. And I showed you how that worked to lowest order perturbation theory. That argument, when generalized to all orders, relates the expectation value of a closed contour to that of an open contour you get by inversion in this way. It's just that for a straight line, we happen to know that this is 1. And so we get the expectation value of the circular Wilson loop. So what we claim is that the expectation value of the circular Wilson loop is given by a Gaussian, the analog of the Wilson loop in a Gaussian, a quadratic matrix model, the simplest possible matrix model. And this function of n and of lambda can be calculated by using the time-ordered method of orthogonal polynomials with this answer. Let me just remind those of you who are too young to remember matrix modelology, how you solve matrix models. You note that the only thing that enters into that functional integral are the eigenvalues of the matrix model. So you integrate out the angles, which gives you this van der Maande determinant product, which can be written as the determinant of the ith eigenvalue to the j minus ith power. Then the trick is to replace the rows in this matrix of powers of the eigenvalues by polynomials, by subtracting other rows. Any polynomial that starts out with this highest power will not change the determinant. You cleverly choose the polynomials to be orthogonal with respect to this measure. In our case, the measure is Gaussian, so that we all know what polynomials are orthogonal with respect to this measure. They're the Hermite polynomials. In more complicated matrix models, which have not just quadratic terms, but interactions, cubic, quartic, etc., you don't know the polynomials exactly. And in discussing double scaling limits and things like that, you use recursion relations for the polynomials to extract what you need to. But here we have explicit expressions. We can expand the determinant as products of these polynomials and do these integrals. The kinds of integrals we have to do are integrals of Hermite polynomials with Gaussian weights, and those you can find in the books. They give you Laguerre polynomials and reproduce the answer that I wrote down, where this is a generalized Laguerre function. So this is the exact matrix model. And if we're right, this is the exact answer for the circular Wilson loop. What about non-perturbative corrections, instantons? Well, we would expect that they don't contribute to this anomaly. This anomaly is all happening at one point, and instantons are smooth. So they shouldn't contribute. Now, as usual in the kind of physics that we've all been involved in the last 10 years, a lot of the justification for my statements will come from the results and the comparison with string theory. So how do we compare this expression with string theory? Well, in string theory, we only know anything about perturbative string theory, so we do a 1 over n, or weak string theory coupling expansion. And with some work, you can take these Laguerre functions and expand them. And it's not totally trivial. You see, n occurs here and here and here and here. But there's a very beautiful expansion of these after some work in terms of Bessel functions of increasing order and increasing powers of 1 over n. You see that, as expected, every matrix model does a nice 1 over n squared expansion. And then furthermore, you'd like to compare this, as we will, with the small alpha prime expressions in string theory. That's large lambda. So each term in 1 over n, you expand for large lambda. That's simple. That's just the large, the behavior of the Bessel function. And it gives you e to the square root of lambda, some power, this expression. We'll come back to that. So we'd like now to compare this with string theory. Well, in string theory, how would we do the calculation if we knew how to treat type 2B string theory in ADS? What we would do is sum over all genus, over all surfaces with P handles. And then, well, if we couldn't do the calculation exactly, we would do a semi-classical expansion about the minimal surface with the contour as our boundary. And we would get e to the minus the area with a boundary term added times some function of the coupling, or of alpha prime, that would be gotten by doing an alpha prime expansion of the fluctuations about the minimal surface. So what can we say about the various terms in this expansion in string theory? Yes? Oh, my God. What can we say? So the area is simple. The minimal area is clearly gotten by taking the minimal area with no handles and adding degenerate handles. So the minimal area should be the same independent of P. That we know. The analysis of this term, of course, is beyond our capability, except for the leading term. Leading term essentially just measures the volume of moduli space. And you can count that by noting, well, you also have to remember that the string coupling is really not 1 over n, but lambda over n. That gives you powers of lambda. You also get extra powers of lambda from every constraint. And you have to count the number of constraints that you have in discussing surfaces with degenerate handles. If you put it all together, you get the power lambda to the 6p minus 3 over 4 for a minimal surface with p handles. You would expect, since they're p handles, to get a factor of 1 over p factorial. But that's sort of in the noise. You can't determine the constant anyway, which depends on p. So this factor comes from the determinant about the dependence on the coupling of the determinant of the fluctuations. This is the string coupling. This is the minimal area. And this is probably all we could say without really having powerful tools to do string theory in ADS. However, if you look here at what we can say from gauge theory, it agrees. 1 over n squared, 1 over n squared, 1 over p factorial. That's sort of a fake. Lambda to the 6p minus 3 over 4, lambda to the 6p minus 3 over 4, e to the square root of lambda. Exact agreement to all orders in 1 over n squared and the leading order in large lambda. Even more remarkable is the agreement with S-duality. The Yang-Mills theory expression that I derived here we can include this extra term, the next to leading term for smaller lambda. And that exponentiates to give a behavior like this. And you see that this is still subdominant as long as lambda is less than n squared. So this is the Yang-Mills result in this big region where n is big and lambda is big, but lambda is less than n squared. And that agrees with string theory. in ADS, but in string theory, I can only use this calculation for n much bigger than lambda, because otherwise the string coupling is getting to be big. What about this region where lambda is much bigger than n but less than n squared? There, the string coupling is big. So you'd have to do an S-duality transformation. And instead of considering fundamental strings, you'd consider D1 strings. And in the gauge theory, this should be the answer not for the Wilson loop, but the dual to the Wilson loop, the Adolf loop. So that enables us both to make a prediction about the behavior of the Ed Hooft loop in Yang-Mills theory, should also go like e to the square root of lambda. And the dual string does go like e to the square root of lambda, because in terms of the dual variables, it goes like e to the square root of lambda. We saw that, but now there's an extra 1 over gs, because it's a d string. This is a remarkable test, I think, of both ADS-CFT, and incidentally justifying our quadratic matrix model, and of S-duality in n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory. So I'll just end with a few remarks. This analysis can be extended to multiply wound loops. If you consider a whole bunch of straight lines, parallel quarks, there's also BPS, and you get 1. That transforms to a whole bunch of circles. Not necessarily of the same concentric. But they all pass through this inversion point. And you can tie these circles together in many different ways. And that corresponds in the matrix model to the general class of observables of multiply wound loops, which is a basis for calculating Wilson loops in any irreducible representation of SUN. And these can also be calculated explicitly by the same techniques, although, of course, it gets harder and harder. We still lack a rigorous proof of this quadratic matrix model for the n equals 4 system, although the agreement with ADS-CFT convinces us that we're right. However, for n equals 2 or 1 conformally invariant theories, the only thing we really need is conformal invariance and some supersymmetry. We might expect, in fact, to get more complicated, perhaps more interesting matrix models. And finally, it would be very nice to start directly from string theory and derive this sort of reduced, trivial C equals minus 2 string theory for this class of conformally in BPS observables. Thank you.
We have time for a couple of quick questions.
Sumit.
I was wondering whether there are other consequences of this conformal anomaly from the supergravity side.
I don't think this anomaly is very consequential. You have to look at observables that really pick out one point. So when you're considering usual correlation functions, which are products of fields at points, the only way you'd get this anomaly is if you made an inversion about one of the points of the Green's function, which is a pretty, you know, a Wilson loop is a different kind of observable which can pass through a point, and it's not unreasonable to consider such a thing. So we've thought a bit about other observables that might exhibit this anomaly, but we haven't given it enough thought. I don't know of any other obvious observables that might be of interest.
If there are no others, one more question.
Is there anything you can say about states other than the vacuum expectation value of the Wilson line? You can think of the state being created by inserting an operator at asymptotic plus and minus infinity.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting, that's one class of observables we might consider. As I remarked, one of the things I was going to discuss, and I think other people will be discussing, are these very interesting observables which have operators inserted onto Wilson loops. They play a big role in non-commutative gauge theory. And so you could imagine doing that in this game as well. But we were fortunate to have a case where one loop was trivial, so we could use this anomaly to calculate the other loop. If you start inserting operators, then you have to be clever to find something that keeps at least one side of the equation trivial and calculable. And I think that's a very interesting thing to try to do, but so far we haven't done that.
The last question.
For what?
Ellipse.
No. Well, no, I'm sorry. There's certainly, if you invert an ellipse, what you get is something which is not an exactly straight line, just asymptotically a straight line. And therefore, it is not trivial. So this anomaly relates an ellipse, the Wilson loop for an ellipse, to the Wilson loop for an inverted ellipse, which is an open contour, but somewhat curved in the middle. But neither side can we calculate trivially. So we can, by the way, I didn't have time to argue that in the leading semi-classical approximation, one can show that this general relation between arbitrary loops, open and closed, is valid in string theory to leading semi-classical order. Does not cancel.
Maybe not the trivial. Discussions can continue further outside. If so, let's thank the speaker once again. And the next speaker will be Sumit Das of the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research, Mumbai, and he'll be speaking on bulk couplings to non-commutative brains.